Hello and welcome to the Arrow Global Q1 2025 results. My name is Sergey, and I'll be your coordinator for today's event. Please note this call is being recorded, and for the duration of the call, your lines will be on a listen-only mode. However, you will have the opportunity to ask questions at the end of the call. This can be done by pressing star one on your telephone keypad to register your question. If you require assistance at any point, please press star zero, and you will be connected to an operator. On the call today, we have Zak Levy, Group Chief Executive Officer and Group Chief Investment Officer, and Phil Shepard, Group Chief Financial Officer. I will now hand you over to your host, Zak Levy, to begin today's conference. Over to you, Mr. Levy. Thank you.
Thank you, Sergey. And as Sergey said, my name is Zachary Levy. I'm the CEO and CIO of Arrow. Summarizing the first quarter of 2025, I guess you start to see in the numbers we've released this morning the pull-through of the substantial progress that we made last year. Last year was a large expansion year where, obviously, having added footprint in Germany, Spain, and France, we strengthened and deepened our geographic footprint. And having launched the lending fund, which, as you know, we had several close-ups last year, we strengthened the product portfolio. And what you've seen to start 2025 is the outcomes of those progressions. First, funds under management increased. That was predominantly driven by the lending fund scaling up. We'll obviously give full details on that once it's had its final close in 2025. We also saw deployments grow strongly. That is also a combined result of both the scale and efficiency of ACO II combined with the lending fund coming on stream. And as we've seen, the third and fourth quarters of 2024 were very strong, as was on a deployment basis the first quarter of 2025. And those three quarters together really powered a fantastic jump in deployment. As Phil will highlight again as you go through his section, that deployment is the start of our corporate fee accretion. We charge on deployed capital. The servicing fees are also on deployed capital. And so both for fund management fees and for servicing fees, that deployment is a key trigger point towards future fee revenue gain and accretion. The other two stats, obviously covering the rest of page one, we delivered well on earnings in the fund management business. Again, we'll give you more detailed breakdown between discretionary strategies and the rest of our fund management and fee income later in the presentation. And realizations remain strong. We had a very strong realization second half of last year, and realizations were above plan again for the first quarter. So I think if you look from an overall perspective, we feel very good that the eight countries we're in constitute our geographic focus on Western Europe and really give us the strong foundation and footprint we want there. The three leading strategies, so our lending strategy, our credit strategy, and our real estate equity strategy, where we've had the second close of our real estate vehicle, those taken together have all delivered a good strategic progression, making us a real leader in that middle market asset-backed Western European asset management space. As we move to page four, you also see in more detail how the strength of that footprint and our operating model, where our servicers now are the platform for $112 billion of assets. And so we continue to get to a really strong scale of our servicing footprint and now a pretty much pan-European coverage in the markets where we focus. And that's largely been delivered now across each of the main products. So we do have good deployment across each of those countries now in ACO, in the lending fund and the real estate equity. It's obviously not exactly equal, and some countries are still ramping up, but there's participatory contribution from each of those countries now to all of the products, and we largely have the footprint we need to do that. So, again, this will be a year of consolidation of that footprint, both geographic and product. We don't see a need to significantly expand any of those aspects to achieve our goals. And so the focus is really, as you see here on page four, raising capital against that strong footprint and franchise, deploying capital against that footprint and franchise, and obviously realizing our previous investments, all of which have gone well. And you'll see the highlights here. A few things I'd point out. Q1's deployment, as we talked about, $756 million, is particularly strong and well up on last year. That's both a strength in ACO and the lending program that drove that. On the realized side, we give you some details, not just on the attributable collections to Arrow between our back book and our fund co-invest, but also some highlight numbers on ACO 2. You will have seen that's moved on very considerably. The 20% deal IRR there after servicing and the 2-1 money multiple are great kind of trajectories for that fund. Obviously, we're now well past the threshold to trigger the raise of further capital in that strategy, which through the SEC rules, we can't be more specific than that, but that is obviously the so what of those metrics that we've highlighted there. And ACO 1 continues to collect well. We've distributed back $326 million. We distributed back $50 million recently in Q2. So we are continuing to return that capital in line with continuing to both raise capital in that strategy, deploy money in that strategy, and return capital to investors in that strategy. So taking together, we're really pleased with that progress in the three key ways we run the business, raising, investing, and realizing. As I move to page five, it clearly our deployment in Q1 had completed before the Trump tariffs noise starting on April 2nd. And so given our deployment tends to be towards the end of quarters, in terms of the weightings, we pretty much done our Q1 deployment before that disruption got in everyone's focus. There's certain asset classes that we continue to see value in despite any increased uncertainty, and so we've been able to deploy in conservative ways. Obviously, distressed credit in Europe against mostly residential real estate is pretty far from the epicenter of the tariff noise. And so we continued both on the lending side, where the LTV of that loan book is in the mid-50s, and in the credit side, we continue to be successful and active despite the tariff noise. There are clearly more cyclical recession risky asset types where we have slowed down, the hospitality, retail, for example, or things that we have experience in and we service, but obviously deciding on the right risk premia for those assets to the extent that a recession follows this noise, it requires, I think, both being very selective and caution. I'd say on the fundraising side, the tariff noise has been a net beneficiary to us. I think investors have been underweight Europe for a very long time and have been pretty tolerant of that. And there are now pockets of the investing world and the institutional world who very much have used this as an occasion, be it for economic reasons, portfolio construction reasons, clarity of outlook reasons, or even political reasons to focus on deploying capital in Europe instead of deploying capital in the U.S. at this moment in time. And as you'll see in coming quarters, we've been a beneficiary of that tailwind. And so the combination of the good ACO2 performance you've seen on the prior page combined with that macro, which I think is net helpful to us on fundraising, has made that a good momentum activity. So that, again, happy in Q&A to cover more pieces. I would just say that there's no assets that we have, certainly nothing, you know, material and nothing we could think of where the direct noise around the tariffs have any impact at all. I mean, we're not in sectors of the economy that directly do import, export, and or trade in those activities. And so it's really the secondary effects of recession that obviously create the overhang risk if one comes in. But so far, we have not seen that on any of the things we're doing. So we haven't seen it in, you know, anything where we're financing, raising money, servicing assets that are asset-backed, you know, real estate-backed in Europe, which is the majority of what we do. There's been no direct effect of the tariff noise. It's more just being cautious about where secondary effect of recession could create, you know, trouble if you're not selective at this stage. Moving forward then, summarizing medium-term targets, which also haven't changed on page six. You know, we've been growing AUM steadily. Obviously, as we move towards ACO 3, we will achieve big chunks of what's here on a number of these points. So in terms of the total FUM target, on the deployment run rate, we're very quickly trending to our medium-term target, as you've seen earlier in the presentation. Those two things alone, particularly the deployment on a continuous basis at these levels, drive that NAV towards that $6 billion piece in terms of the NAV that's in our discretionary strategies. And that is the key to the economic pull-through. The return on assets, and again, we'll showcase the lending fund and any future credit fund just to reaffirm those unit metrics in the future, but we can tell you they're on track to deliver this return on our portion of co-invest. As Phil has highlighted many times in the past, there's been no drop in those in that fee context, which is great. So, and as you see, ACO2 has been deploying at that stronger level. The co-invest for those have come down over time, again, as we've highlighted in previous presentations. So, in terms of return on our capital deployed, this 40% target is where we're currently trending on deployment. And all of that just brings down in a sustainable way the leverage, obviously, as the denominator comes from fee income. There's no replacement rate concept. It is just recurring captive revenue on those funds, which, just remind you, are 3+5+2-year vehicles. So long-term support to the denominator, and that drives leverage down over time. Obviously, at this point, you've seen leverage creep up as we foreshadowed during our fund refinance back at the end of last year. Obviously, that's still impacted by the back book, which existed pre the funds model. But as you see, that keeps getting smaller as a piece of it. And the fund management income, which is the recurring no replacement rate capital light income, has been growing very strongly. And so as we continue to scale that in the denominator of this calc, it basically becomes a very sustainable declining curve, which we expect to see in the forward period. But again, Phil, we'll give you more color on that. So that's the summary of how the business is trending, a very steady, quite functional quarter, and we're happy with that progress. And with that, I'll pass to Phil.
Thanks, Zach. Good morning, everyone. Slide 8 has the results of our integrated fund management segment, which includes the capital-light earnings from both our discretionary fund management and our third-party asset management activities. Total fee-related earnings grew 30% year-on-year to $18 million, with strong revenue growth and a slight widening of the margin. Overall revenues grew by 29% to $75.1 million, which comprises a 48% rise in the discretionary fund management revenues to $34 million and a 17% rise in the third-party asset management revenues to $41.1 million. Slide 9 has further analysis on the performance of our discretionary fund management business, which includes the fees generated from both fund management and asset management and servicing activities provided to our discretionary funds, Arrow Credit Opportunities, ACO, our real estate fund, Arrow Real Estate Opportunities, AREO, and our lending fund, Arrow Lending Opportunities, ALO. The group primarily generates returns from deployed capital, with deployment of capital driving the growth in the fee-earning NAV of the funds, which in turn drives the revenues. The record Q1 deployment of €756 million has driven growth in the fee-earning NAV from €2.5 billion as at Q1 2024 and €3.4 billion at the end of 2024 to €4.1 billion as at the end of Q1 2025, and an average NAV of 3.1 billion sterling during the quarter. This growth in the fee-earning NAV has delivered an increase in the discretionary fund management fee-related revenues of 48%, or 11.1 million to 34 million. Based upon a 10% co-investment level, the group targets capital-light returns of 30% on the capital invested by Arrow, broadly split 10% from fund management activities, 10% from asset management and servicing, and 10% from performance fees. And to date, we have not recognised any performance fees. Given we generate fees on deployed capital, and there is upfront investment in people and systems to build fundraising and investment capabilities, there is an inherent lag between the current deployment and the build of the income streams. Slide 22 in the appendix that I discussed on the year-end earnings call demonstrates the expected build in capital-light revenue streams based upon continued deployment at current levels. Slide 10 summarises the results of the IFM segment earnings, showing the split between the discretionary fund management and the third-party asset management activities. As noted on prior earnings calls, the EBITDA derived from our discretionary fund management is a function of the average fee-paying NAV. Of $3.1 billion at the 30% margin on Arrow co-investments that I explained a moment ago, and since we are not yet recognising any carry or performance fees, then the implied EBITDA is $15 million. The third-party asset management activity is typically at a 15% EBITDA margin, and therefore the implied EBITDA is $6 million based upon the revenues of $41 million. I reiterate that I expect third-party asset management revenues to grow at a mid to high single-digit percentage through the cycle, with average margins maintained at circa 15% for the broad array of services provided. In addition, there is the ongoing investment drag of circa $2 million during the quarter as we continue to scale operations and certain activities are not yet fully at the required operational leverage. These three component parts help to understand the overall IFM EBITDA of $18 million delivered during Q1 2025. Turning now to slide 11 and the results of the balance sheet segment. This segment reflects the investment returns of the back book investments along with the returns generated on our co-investments in our discretionary funds, ACO, ALO and AREO. EBITDA in Q1 2024 included circa $4 million of non-cash impairment gains and one-off Concordato income on certain Italian portfolios, which have not repeated in Q1 2025. Combined with the 12% reduction in the average balance, this has resulted in a $6.3 million reduction in EBITDA to $11.3 million. The realizations performance in the quarter was $50.3 million, representing 133% of expectations. Full year realization expectations are circa $270 million, with realizations over the next 9 months expected to be $219 million. As I've explained on prior earnings calls, the realizations on secured portfolios are typically lumpier in nature, with the 33% overperformance predominantly arising due to the acceleration of realizations. Balance sheet investments increased by $62 million during the quarter to $768 million, driven by the record Q1 deployment. Our co-investment levels continue to reduce, with typical co-investments in ACO1 at 25%, reduced to 10% in ACO2, and reduced further to 7% in ALO. I expect future funds, in particular ACO3, to have co-investment levels below 10% and more in line with ALO. Slide 12 shows the overall result together with the group segment performance. Group costs primarily relate to the centrally controlled overheads and were $2.3 million higher than prior year at $9.9 million. However, the costs were $0.3 million lower than Q4 2024. Over the previous 12 months, the business has scaled significantly with the launch of the lending fund, the expansion into new geographies, and as such, there has been a build in the talent and capabilities leading to the growth in the group costs. Obviously, this has contributed to the record deployments in Q1 and the build of capital-light earnings growth. The current level of group segmental costs is reflective of a business scaled to deliver deployment volumes of circa 2 to 3 billion euros per annum without any need for significant cost increase. The full underlying income statement is also shown on this slide. Overall, the loss before tax has widened by 20 million to 23.6 million. Along with the segmental results that I have explained, there are two further significant impacts driving this movement. Firstly, as the group grows the euro income, predominantly due to the growth in management fees and in due course carried interest in our funds, the group is maintaining a net euro liability position. The retranslation of this liability position gives rise to some non-cash P&L volatility and was an 8.7 million loss in Q1 2025 against a gain of 1.9 million reported in Q1 2024 with a year-on-year variance of 10.6 million. Secondly, finance costs have increased year-on-year by 4.2 million, rising from 26.6 million to 30.8 million, primarily due to the refinancing completed in late 2024. Moving to slide 13 and the detailed breakdown of the free cash flow generation. Given the significant level of deployment in the quarter, there's been an outflow with portfolio investments exceeding free cash flow generation by 56.7 million. This compares with an uplift in the level of balance sheet investments of 62 million. Typical co-investment levels are reducing. 7% for ALO and 10% in ACO2, with an expectation that future funds will have co-investment levels of below 10% closer to the level of ALO. Therefore, as we scale deployment volumes, the euro equivalent level of our co-investments will not increase at the same pace, as our integrated fund management fee-related earnings continue to build. Alongside this proportionately reduced investment requirement, the free cash flow generation will continue to deliver the sustainable deleveraging of the balance sheet. Moving on to slide 14, which shows our leverage funding position. The group's liquidity position and funding base are strong, with maturities now pushed out to 2029 following the refinancing completed in Q4 2024, with a liquidity headroom of 266 million, significantly above the remaining stub of the existing bonds of 98 million due in 2026 and 2027. Leverage has reduced by 0.8 times since 2021, the date of the take private transaction, and by 0.2 times over the past 12 months. There has been an increase to 4 times since the year end, predominantly due to the $104 million increase in net debt. And net debt has risen primarily as a result of the strong deployment, with our co-investment amounting to $77 million in the quarter. In addition, there has been a $13 million increase due to the movement in the foreign exchange rate and $24 million working capital outflow caused by the payment of annual bonuses in the quarter. The capital-light business model continues to deliver sustainable deleveraging. It is also important to highlight that the leverage calculation uses adjusted EBITDA in the denominator of the calculation. Therefore, equal weighting is placed to £1 worth of discretionary fee-related earnings as it is to £1 worth of realizations, which clearly requires an upfront investment of circa 60 pence to generate. Our capital-light model leaves us well-placed to continue to expand our integrated fund management proposition across credit, real estate and lending, in turn further driving fee-related earnings growth without placing strain on our balance sheet and facilitating sustainable deleveraging towards the strategic leverage commitment of 3 times. Thank you, and I'll now hand back to Zach.
Thank you, Phil. So to conclude on page 16, we've continued to drive the business forward in the key areas as discussed. We added over $1 billion of AUM year on year, obviously predominantly in the lending franchise, which is now over $1 billion. We've been able to drive deployment up almost 3x, a little bit more than 3x, which obviously, as Phil describes, is the start of the long-term fee revenue driving that comes off that deployment as the trigger point. And realizations were slightly ahead of plan, which obviously is important in terms of investor results as well as the IRRs of the funds, et cetera, and obviously the portion of that that's balance sheet to our own capital efficiency and performance. Consequently, it is no more complicated or more simple than that. It is just nailing those 3 business activities in good, focused ways over the quarter just finished, which has produced very strong outcomes on all 3 key areas, and will be the same through the course of this year as we continue to focus on that after having expanded substantially last year on geography and product. We're not going to do that this year. This year is going to be a focus on just simply driving, raising capital, investing capital, and achieving strong realizations as we did in Q1. And with that, Sergey, I'll pass the question. Thank you.
Thank you. And as a reminder, to ask a question at this time, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you wish to cancel your request, please press star 2. And please make sure the mute function on your phone is switched off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, it is star 1 to ask a question. I will pause for just a moment to allow you to signal. And our first question is from Ryan Flute from PVTL Point. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking the call. Just a quick one from me, if I may. So you mentioned sort of the carry isn't included in the numbers, and obviously we appreciate historically it hasn't been. Are you guys able to give any further guidance as to when we can kind of expect the first wave of, I guess, the ACO1 payments to come in? I think we'd previously noted it might come towards the end of this year, but sort of any further color on that and quantums to the extent you can comment on it would be really appreciated.
Yeah, sure. So the guidance we've given is that the Arrow share of ACO1 carry will be around about €40 million, and we expect recognition during the course of next year. The accounting allows you to recognize slightly ahead of the actual cash collection, but not by very much. And so we actually expect the cash collection to come in late next year or early early 2027 with recognition next year. For ACO2, the level of carry will be quite a bit higher, and there's really a couple of things driving that. One is the fact that Arrow, the amount that comes to the house is 50% rather than the 33-34% for ACO1, and also obviously the size of the fund is significantly bigger, and also the size of the third party LP is higher. Arrow's co-invest is reduced, and we don't pay our carry on our co-investment, and so the level of ACO2 carry should be 100 to 125 million euros, that sort of range, and we'd expect sort of recognition probably 2030, sort of that timing. Obviously, that's some time out, and you know, dependent upon realizations over the interim period.
Right. Thanks very much.
Thank you. As a reminder, to ask a question at this time, please signal by pressing star 1. We will pause for a moment to allow you to signal. We will now take our next question from Samik Majumdar from CreditSights. Please go ahead.
Hi, morning everyone. Thanks for taking my question. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for the presentation. Just a quick, and I know we have discussed this before, but just to refresh, how should we align the economics in terms of, so if I look at the discretionary fund management revenues on an annualized basis, it's roughly around, right now, something around 3.5% of the NAV. So just wanted to, to let you can disclose, like, how does that tie in with the fee income and so on? Like, how do you think about how the economics work and how it develop further? And the second question was in terms of liquidity, on the positive side, deployments have been quite successful, but how do you think about your funding needs, because you do have the 98 million stuff to pay out and deployments, so do you think deployments would slow down somewhere around the end of this year, or do you think you need more funding sources to match them?
You for the question. I'll take the first half of that, Patsy, to provide any further detail. I appreciate the question. Getting to the core of how it works, on the funds transferring to fees, like the 3.5% of NAV, the way it works is that there's a split of different fee income there, right? So we have management fees similar to other managers, and the ACO fees are higher, the credit fees are higher than the lending fees. But both are strong fee levels. So the credit fees, I think we've disclosed in the past, are comfortably above 1%, for example, and the lending fees we can talk about in due course when the lending fund is no longer active in market. But that is only part of the fee gain we get off those discretionary fund strategies. The other half of it is obviously those strategies overwhelmingly use our platforms. Our platforms charge market rates for their activities, and so Phil has guided in the past that there's a net management fee pickup, there's a servicing fee pickup, there's a carry fee pickup, and then there's the balance sheet performance on our portion of the co-invest. And so for every dollar that we deploy, those four things combined add up to about a 40% return on that dollar, roughly equally weighted between them, with carry in with the fund management fee. So again, Phil can give much more detailed guidance if that isn't enough. If you run your own fund and you're trying to compare it out, you kind of have to, evolve your thought process is the way I've just described it. Obviously, the management fees, if we disclose them exactly, you could run right across. Carry is typical of a fund manager. You know, the base levels are 20 over an 8, and then some LPs get discounts. And then the servicing fee is the one that's hard to summarize other than the way that Phil's described it. And so, we have covered that in some detail in past calls, and happy to take it offline to reconcile if that helps.
I know that's helpful. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, no, appreciate that. And then on the liquidity point, and apologize if that got lost in the subtlety. I mean, if you go back, what we have historically disclosed is that our co-invest alongside ACO1 was 25% of the money. Our co-invest along ACO2 is 10% of the money. Our lending fund, we have indicated, we can't give the exact details until that fund comes out of market, but it's considerably lower than 10, and that we would, and Phil today highlighted that we would expect that ACO3 in the future would also be quite a bit lower than 10. And so we will clarify that as soon as those funds are out of the market, but the reason the liquidity is attractive versus the forward deployment is not that deployments, as we've defined them here, i.e. our funds deploying, are not going to slow down. By contrast, you know, those are going to speed up to the $3 billion a year target that we've highlighted. It's that the balance sheets co-invest alongside that deployment is going to reduce quite considerably as a percentage. And so you will see that the combination of more deployment, i.e. the $3 billion target we have in the docs, which will be the anchor for the fee income streams, but less contribution of that coming from our own balance sheet, which is falling significantly fund over fund. And therefore, you'll get the positive accretion of more fees that drive cash flow and less cash going out in side-by-side co-invest. And so we're very comfortable that the amount of balance sheet capacity we have will fulfill both key activities. One, obviously paying back the stub in 26, 27 or earlier. And two is fulfilling the co-invest we have alongside our funds, where deployment is growing and that is going to create a capital requirement, but Arrow's portion of the co-invest is shrinking and as a ratio. And hence, it will take down the kind of cash draw off the balance sheet to achieve that higher level of deployment. Our co-invest as a ratio is shrinking faster than the deployment is growing. And again, we'll provide further guidance on that as soon as we can once we're outside of the kind of SEC quiet period of the fundraisers. But hopefully that's a helpful explanation. But Phil, I don't know if there's anything you'd add there.
I'd just point to the liquidity headroom. So that's the cash and the headroom that we've got on the committed revolving credit facility. And obviously, we extended the maturity of the revolving credit facility as part of the refinancing at the back end of last year. So that the maturity of that is also 2029. And at the end of Q1, we were drawn $96 million on the $285 million. Which gives us the $266 million of liquidity headroom, which is clearly significantly higher than the stub notes. And you will recall at the time of the refinancing, we took new money and we limited the amount of new money that we took to just cover the stub and the and any refinancing of the existing bonds. So we created the headroom in the RCF money at the time of the refinancing.
No, of course, you do have about $200 million.
Has that answered your question, Sumit?
Yes. And I think the way I would look at it, I suppose, is your current deployment LTM is about 200. So I think what you're suggesting is even with overall deployments at $3 billion, and assuming less than 10%, you shouldn't be too far above that in the long run or in a steady state. I was just wondering if it might spike a bit above 200 maybe through the middle of this year, but I understand that in the long run, that's where it stays, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. And as we scale origination further, then, yeah, it may be slightly higher in the early part of this year, but it will trend down as future funds about lower co-investment percentage are more of an impact than they are now. Yeah.
And just to clarify on the first question, sorry, I'm taking a bit of time, but just to be clear, the 40% that you broke out, the carry part is obviously not in the income levels right now. That's a one-off fee that comes in later. And the balanced return is also, I guess, part of your balanced income. So the 3.5% is essentially, the reason it's higher than the typical 2% we would assume is because of the platform fees, which is about half of it. That's why it's at around 3.5 instead of around 2. Is that correct?
So I'm not sure where you're getting your 3.5%.
So if I look at the fee
Yeah. So the revenue of $34 million, based upon a $3.1 billion of average NAV during the period, gets you to around about 4.4% of revenue. That is basically comprised, because we're not recording any performance fees. It's round about one and a quarter, something like that, is management fees, and that's the revenue, and around about 3% of revenue from the servicing activities. They clearly have very different margins, those two components. So the 2% return, which is in the calculation of the 40% return from our co-investment level, which comprises the balance sheet return, performance fees, and then the 2% return on NAV, or 20% return on our co-investment share, is based upon, broadly speaking, of that the management fees at the revenue of around about 1.25%. percent, driving an EBITDA of 1%, and the servicing fees of around about 3%, broadly a 33% margin, giving you an EBITDA on the asset management and servicing activity of the 1%. I'm happy to take that offline.
I think that's clear here now. But yeah, I'll discuss offline if anything. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And our next question is from Bruno Reed Cutting from ADF Asset Management. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi guys. Thanks for the presentation. Could I just ask about the collections for the remaining of this year? Any sort of changes to the seasonality or lumpiness around that, given the changing macro picture? That would just be good to understand. And obviously, you mentioned that obviously do have some sort of more recessionary impacted sectors like hospitality and retail. Could you maybe put some sort of numbers around what proportion of, I guess, your NAV that actually is?
I'll take the second part and maybe you take the first part if that works. Appreciate the question. On the second part, so we do own a business called Details, which is a servicing business that operates in the hospitality sector. Up till now, that has performed incredibly well, i.e. the macro, which has moved business activity and people's time spending to Southern Europe, where that business operates, has far outweighed any other macro noise. So the ADRs and the assets that are managed there and the recurring EBITDAs for bookings, all of the various metrics have all been strongly positive year over year. we have almost none of that asset on our balance sheet. It'd be a micro percentage. In the fund, depending on the fund, there is some participation in those assets. But to Arrow Corporate, their pro rata share is not a material number. It's more in some of our deployment markets, that's an area we do consider. I mean, we have 24 platforms that feed our funds, and this is one of 24. So it's not a material distraction if it isn't there. But it obviously, to the extent we've been growing deployment strongly, period on period, you'd like to see all the platforms participate, and we've obviously treated those more cyclical industries like hospitality and retail with more caution subsequent to the tariffs, and so we haven't done a deal in that space over the last, if that were to continue, it would knock out one of the origination streams that we would otherwise be well positioned to participate in. So I mean, obviously, if there's a big dislocation there, it'll create an even bigger opportunity. If it's just simply sellers ignore the macro and we want to get a higher return premium for any macro risk, then it would stay in the way. But so it's a back book exposure. It's not a material risk to fund deployment. It's been a non-material but still positive addition to the growth in the deployment that you've seen, but it's something that we're obviously having to treat with caution this quarter, and until either sellers adjust by reducing the prices of those assets, or until we see clearer trajectory on how those assets would perform in the future. We've obviously slow down any origination in that sector, but again, it's one of 24 platforms. It's not a material piece. It's just given we've been asked, and I'm sure you guys have wanted to see any impact of tariffs. That's probably the one place we would highlight is something that requires further consideration. Otherwise, the super majority of our business is asset-backed residential credits in Europe, where we're pretty far away from the front line of the tariff noise. But anyway, Phil, in terms of the lumpiness of collections,
yeah,
do you want to take that one?
Yeah, obviously you see the profile of the expected realizations on slide 24 in the appendix, and you can see that for the remainder of this year we've got 219 million, which is split 102 million back book and 117 million on our co-investment. There's no specific lumpiness to those. Obviously, there's a couple of factors. Obviously, the back book is where we are obviously 100% of the collection. Obviously created in 2024. A number of portfolios which were quite sizable and therefore created more lumpiness, whereas that's now resolved. And also the key is that we're continuing to see good realizations. We're obviously 33% over performance in Q1, and that's largely the acceleration of collections performance. So no specific quarter on quarter lumpiness that this year and accelerations has been very strong in Q1.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. So that's roughly called like 70, 75 million a quarter. What would you think the sort of net margin on that would be? So obviously I know obviously now that you have different margin profiles across those, the back book and the co-investment, but what do you kind of think the blended would be?
I don't think it would be any different from what we'd normally expect. So it's around about 20% on the back book in terms of the cost to collect, and that's probably slightly higher than the historical 15% that we've people have generally quoted. And that's because we include a management fee in our you know, our balance sheet business pays a management fee to our integrated fund management business. And then on the co-investment side, it is just those fund related costs, so largely management fee. So that broadly equates to around about a 5% cost decline, something of those or that something of that order.
Okay, thank you. And then I've just got two other questions, but the first one was just obviously around your guys, the investments that you're making off your balance sheet. And obviously, I know you talked a lot around this, but just again, to understand the quarterly cadence there, because obviously I know ACO 3 is going to be more of a Q3 event, obviously for the lending fund, which has ramped up. But how, you know, is the originations you did in this quarter representative of what we should expect, or would it kind of slow down and then ramp up again? Just be good to understand that.
Yeah, it's a great question. As you highlighted, ACO tends to, in order of sequencing, have Q4 as its biggest quarter, Q2 as its second biggest quarter, and then Q1 and Q3 tend to be slower. For various reasons. I mean, obviously Q3 is July, August, and September, which in Europe tends to be generally slow. Q1, you have this issue, which is a lot of the banks that have sold at Q4 have it reloaded to immediately sell again in Q1. So Q1 and Q3 usually lag the action versus Q2 and Q4, with Q4 being the bigger of them as people clean their books for year end. That's the ACO cadence. The ALO cadence is more balanced. There isn't if the lending activity doesn't have a cyclicality to it in the same seasonal form. So it should in that regard balance out and prove generally more consistent quarter to quarter, with Q2 and Q4 being on the bigger side. The only thing I would just caution is that as a practitioner, that's the theory of it, and that is the general lived experience. But it's not cleanly so. We had an Irish deal that was sizable that we really wanted to finish off in Q1, and it fell into the kind of second week of Q2 just by the time it all got done. Like some of these things just fall, without quite the same strictness of deadline, and just slip into the quarter before. And so that Irish deal I mentioned, for example, was something that, you know, we really felt was going to be in the prior quarter, and certainly the majority of the work occurred in the prior quarter. But by the time you got through the papering of the final items, including some conditions precedence to closing, it actually completed, you know, one quarter later. So I think if you're modeling it, you can definitely model Q4 to be bigger, Q2 to be bigger, Q1 and Q3 to be a little smaller off that $3 billion normalized medium term rate. And you would generally be accurate. That's certainly how we budget it internally as we look at it. But I mean, just being transparent, it doesn't always play exactly that way, because we obviously close the deals in the highest quality way we can. And so if that happens to take an extra 6 days or 9 days or what have you, we're not going to adjust the way in which we transact the opportunity to try and land it on a calendar. So it's directionally, that's the right answer, but you should expect some volatility. So Q1 was larger than it would normally be in a cyclical form, but trending obviously in the direction we've guided.
Okay. All right. That's helpful. Thank you. And then my last question is obviously, like, I guess this kind of stage of the business is obviously, under TVR's ownership, is obviously pointing towards their sort of exit. But I'm just sort of curious, like, where do you think the business needs to get to for that to be possible? Do you kind of think the ACO 3 raise kind of completes that, or do you kind of think you have to be on to the next one? Just kind of curious, and just, you know, sort of what's the sort of point at which this becomes the appropriate sort of level with enough growth ahead, but also sizable in the transition to look attractive to sell?
Yeah. I'll answer that very bluntly, even though I guess shareholder intentions are, you know, above our pay grade. What I would say is that we are already, I'd say, a strong talking point of the consolidation that's happening in the asset management and all space. I guess, depending on your metric, we're probably the largest independent European private manager at this stage. You can debate, you know, depending on the metrics. But you've obviously seen that the M&A activity in this space is almost like a weekly event in terms of global actions now. So I think to answer your direct question, the business is already mature enough, and I think our products are mature enough, and the quality of our investors is strong enough that I think the market would embrace us as the European middle market asset-backed leader for Western Europe in the activities we're doing, and that's a valuable spot on the chessboard. I mean, that total space is about a 4 trillion euro space, and we service 112 billion in there, and we're the largest of the vertically integrated players. I don't think we need to continue to evolve the firm to achieve what TDR would consider, you know, a very strong, with the market, I guess equally importantly, would consider a very strong franchise position for exit or TDR purposes. I think the thing I would say, though, is that obviously we are incredibly confident on ACO3 fundraising, and ACO3 does move us obviously materially closer to the medium-term metrics we flagged in the presentation both last year and today. And so I think we'd be a buyer of that execution risk as opposed to a seller of it. And so I don't think you'll see anything in the near term as we deliver the current funds, deliver ACO 3 in due course. I think we want to do that with the success and the stability and the momentum of the franchise as it is now. So I don't think we need to do anything, frankly, to achieve the quality of franchise that the market would pay for. But I think we all are hugely excited about ACO3 and want to do that in the current form before we consider any distractions of that kind of a process.
Okay, got it. Thanks. And do you think in the next results we'll get a more sort of holistic update there, or do you think it could get pushed beyond that?
I mean, the annoying bit
on the fundraising.
Yeah. Well, the problem is the SEC rules. Yeah, exactly. I mean, the SEC rules stop us giving like a blow by blow of live fundraisings. So what I would say is we have historically, because we've deemed them material to the public company, you know, to these bonds. I mean, we have given updates on closings, you know, first closings of new vehicles and things like that, where that's material news that we're kind of forced to publicly disclose under the materiality threshold. And we'll do that again here in, I guess, what, the next results are in August announcement. So, yeah, I mean, we will, let's obviously let events play out, but we will update you as soon as we're able to.
Okay, cool. That's very clear. Thank you.
Thank you. As a reminder, to ask a question at this time, please signal by pressing star 1. We'll pause for another moment to allow you to signal. And we'll now take our next question from Carl Strecker from Guggenheim. Please go ahead. Carl Strecker, please go ahead. Your line is open. Please make sure the mute function on your phone is switched off. We can't hear you. And it seems that Carl has stepped away. There are currently no further questions. With this, I'd like to hand the call back over to Mr. Lewy for closing remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Sergey. I appreciate everyone's time and engagement today. And yeah, we the next earnings will be in August, and we look forward to talking to you through Q2 and H1 at that time. So thank you. Talk then. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference call. Thank you for your participation, ladies and gentlemen. You may now disconnect.